From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson reflects on his first term in office and what he hopes to accomplish in his second term. Then we'll explore the impact of new legislation that requires Asian American and Hmong American history to be taught in Wisconsin schools.
Wisconsin has the third largest Hmong population. For the Hmong students now, they'll know about themselves and their culture and their identities, and their peers will know more about them, which then will foster more belonging.
Plus, we'll speak with the RuPaul's Drag Race queen at the center of the documentary Ladylike about her life.
I've always had a hard time really gaining the confidence to like fully be myself for like most of my life. And that's not really something you want to hear a drag queen say. You know, that's not what you expect them to say.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. It's Inauguration Day in the city of Milwaukee, where Mayor Cavalier Johnson was reelected to a second term in office with more than 80% of the vote. This will be the mayor's first full term in office, having previously won a special election in 2022 after the resignation of former Mayor Tom Barrett. Mayor Johnson has an ambitious outlook for the city of Milwaukee, which he shares with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. A note to listeners, this interview has been edited for time. You can find the full, unedited interview at WUWM.com.
Reflecting on your, you know, relatively short term in office, what are the biggest lessons that you've learned?
The biggest lessons that I've learned are that this job as mayor of Milwaukee, the largest and most diverse and economically consequential community in the state of Wisconsin, a city in which roughly one in 10 Wisconsinites live, it's a big job. And I knew that going in. I had served in the mayor's office beforehand for some time, but it's a difficult, complicated, complex, but very rewarding job, and it presents the opportunity to make an impact on the lives of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that call the city of Milwaukee home. And I appreciate that, and having the ability and the trust of voters, my constituents in the city of Milwaukee, to go about that business. And one thing that I have learned and had to learn really quickly here is that there are a lot of things that are within the mayor's control, but there are a lot of things that are outside of the mayor's control. And I have to, as mayor, understand the political reality on the ground in order to get the ball moving forward for the citizens that I serve in Milwaukee.
It's interesting, during your time in office, there has been this kind of interplay between both the city, the county, and the state, and really these questions around home rule. What do we have power over here in the city of Milwaukee? Act 12, of course, was a landmark piece of legislation that I know you had a hand in. Mm-hmm. And while it did give the city more control over its revenue, it also came with a lot of strings attached. When it was announced, there was talk of the city challenging some of the provisions that were specific to the city of Milwaukee. What happened to that?
Well, you're right. Act 12 did present an incredible opportunity. I mean, the first time in literally decades where we were in a position to address some of the financial challenges that we faced in the city of Milwaukee. I mean, before I took office, there had been attempts by administrations in the past to rectify what we knew was going to come, which was this doomsday scenario in which we didn't have enough revenue coming in to support the services that we deliver to our constituents on a daily basis. And so what I mean by that is that the shared revenue program, which goes back to 1911, when we all go out and pay our sales taxes, when we purchase something, those sales tax revenues go to the state. The state's supposed to divvy those dollars up and send them back in an equitable way to local governments from which they came. That wasn't happening anymore. That, you know, sort of fell apart some decades ago because we were not getting that support. It put us in a position where we had to continually make cuts, and sometimes, you know, these cuts that I disagree with and don't want to see in terms of like public safety, for instance. But we had to in order to keep our city budgets afloat. So Act 12 presented an opportunity for us to address that situation, allowing the city of Milwaukee to raise a sales tax, which we were the probably one of the largest cities in America that didn't have the ability to do that, and then also increase shared revenue for the first time, again, in decades. So it's a great accomplishment. It didn't solve every single piece of our financial problems that we faced here, but it certainly put us in a stronger position than we were in before. Now, there were other provisions in the bill that I certainly disagreed with and didn't want to see. However, at the same time, and I think that I just mentioned this in a meeting that I had just earlier this morning with an older person. You have to understand the political reality on the ground. Like, if I want to move the ball forward for Milwaukee, and you know the legislature is made up the way that it is, and you know that's not you know my particular desire for the legislature to have the composition that it does, but that's what it is right now. Right. And I have to work within those confines in order to make sure that we're in the best position possible. So there were talks of doing things like that. I'm interested in looking at and have been interested in looking at, you know, what, you know, sort of oversteps or overreaches may have happened there. However, at the same time, like, you know, we struck a deal that put us in a stronger position with the doors that were open to us in Madison. And so, I'm happy with what we're able to accomplish at that time. Are there things I would love to change? Absolutely, there are things I love to change.
Another issue a lot of Milwaukeeans have been very concerned about, and it does actually speak to public safety, is reckless driving. Mm-hmm. I think all of us have dealt with it in one way or another. Road diets have become increasingly common in Milwaukee during your time here. That's where roads are given a variety of things like bike lanes, protected parking, and bump outs in hope that it'll slow down drivers. A preliminary study, suggests that they've been effective. Mm-hmm. But many of these diets have been done through things like, you know, painted lines and these mm-hmm. kinds of temporary cones and things. Are there plans to make more permanent changes to the roads in Milwaukee?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that I'm happy to address. So the answer is yes, and in some respects, since I've been mayor and have declared reckless driving on day number one in that office, as acting mayor even, I declared reckless driving a public safety crisis in Milwaukee and corralled all of government to find solutions to address the issue. So, yes, there are some temporary fixes that are out there right now in anticipation for things that will be more permanent down the line. Now, it's quick and it's easy but effective to have some of these temporary, you know, paint and posts, things that are out there on the streets to stop people from driving in a particular area to let folks know what may be coming. It's more expensive to actually pour the concrete and do the engineering and possibly move some utilities in order to make some of these infrastructure projects work. However, we have made a significant change to the roadways in Milwaukee with actual physical changes, actual concrete that has been poured. So when you talk about protected bike lanes, which in my State of the City address back in 2023, I said by 2026, I'd like to have 50 miles of protected bike lanes either completed or in the works to be done. And we're well on the way to in order to get that done, because I believe that paint itself does not protect. Right. So we have to do a job of signaling that, you know, these changes are coming and hopefully get people to change some of their behaviors by having paint and posts. But then ultimately, at the end of the day, the best solution is to have the full engineering change. And that requires concrete to be poured. That requires our pinned on curb extensions, which we've seen a lot of in Milwaukee in my time as mayor. It requires us to build out this protected bikeway network. That'll be a citywide network that I am really, really proud of, because it presents an opportunity for young, talented, educated people who are very mobile and fall in love with a city before they select to choose a job in that location. If you're building that people-centered infrastructure that makes Milwaukee a more attractive place for them, especially as we look to grow the city. But then it also provides an avenue for kids who live in the neighborhoods that I lived in growing up. When I was a kid, well, we rode our bikes forever, as an adult, I don't even remember like how far we went. I can't even recognize the neighborhood that we went to. We just rode so far. And I think about last year, this young man who was riding his bike over on Fond du Lac Avenue and unfortunately was hit by somebody driving recklessly. Well, kids in the neighborhoods deserve to ride their bikes and to do so safely as well. And so we're building this infrastructure for them as well, tier two.
Now, you mentioned a bit of this, but one of the things you've been really passionate about is attracting people to the city of Milwaukee. You, in fact, I believe, have a goal of growing the city to 1 million people.
Yes.
That number is very ambitious. Mm-hmm. What are some of the steps that you've taken to attract people to the city? You, of course, said road diets are part of that. What are some of the other things?
Yes. So our investment in infrastructure and people-centered infrastructure in Milwaukee is a key part of that. Another thing that I think is really important is making sure that folks have access to good-paying and family-supporting jobs. I mean, that's good for people. You can't get to 1 million if you're losing people who are here, too. Right? It's not just attracting people. It's also making sure that we retain people as well here, too. And so I want to make sure that we're building and growing good-paying, family-supporting jobs here to retain our talented individuals who live in the city, to attract other high-skilled, educated individuals who would come to Milwaukee with jobs at places like Pfizer, for instance, or Milwaukee Tool, for instance, and places like that. But also, as the city grows and buildings have to be erected for people to live in, whether they're luxury apartments or whether they're affordable housing elsewhere in the city, too, that presents an opportunity for folks in the union construction trades, which manufacturing may not be what it once was. Now, we have a significant number of manufacturing jobs here and in the region. I think we're number two per capita in manufacturing, which is great, and I support those jobs and would be eager to have more of those jobs here. But the fact of the matter is that it's not what it was decades and decades ago, but there still is a fantastic opportunity for individuals in Milwaukee to have access to a good-paying, family-supporting career in the union construction trade. So as we build the city, we create more job opportunities for folks who are here and may not have high-level degrees, but are still looking for work. So it's our infrastructure changes. It's making sure that folks have access to good-paying work. It's recognizing Milwaukee's past in terms of being a city that was open to immigrants. When you look at Milwaukee's past, we used to be one of the most immigrant-heavy cities in the United States. Once upon a time, Milwaukee was the 11th largest city in the country. And a large part of that was driven by the growth that we saw from folks who were coming to the United States for the first time. So immigration has to play a key role in that. In fact, our numbers, our population numbers, were buoyed by the fact that we saw a lot of immigration coming to Milwaukee over the course of the last decade or so. So it's those things. It's public safety and making sure that folks not just, think that they're safe, but that they actually feel safe in their neighborhoods. That goes to the point that I was making earlier about making more investments in police and in fire, and not just in police and fire. They play an incredible role, certainly, but they're not the only things. It's working with nonprofit organizations, working with youth-serving organizations, making sure that kids have access to youth job opportunities, like our Summer Youth Jobs Program, Earn and Learn, or our Camp Rise program that provides an alternative to kids who might get, sucked up in this, sort of bad scenario where they're out, stealing cars or things like that. It provides an alternative to things like that. It's making sure kids have access to the Boys and Girls Club and to the United Neighborhood Centers of Milwaukee and the programming there, or the YMCA, like I was involved in when I was a kid growing up. It's all these things together and more that'll help us to grow the city.
Well, Mayor Johnson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, and good luck for your first full term.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That was Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson speaking with Lake Effect's Joy Powers ahead of today's inauguration. This interview was edited for Time, and you can find the full, unedited version at WUWM.com. On April 4th, Governor Tony Evers signed legislation that mandates the inclusion of Asian American and Hmong American history, culture, and contributions be a part of the curriculum in schools across the state. The new law, known as Act 266, amends Act 31, adding Asian communities to existing requirements schools have to teach American Indian, Black, and Hispanic histories. Ihir Vang and Lorna Young are both members of the Asian American and Pacific Islander Coalition of Wisconsin, and both have been working since 2021 to make this a reality in schools. They joined WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, and Ihir Vang starts by explaining the significance of this change.
Having grown up in Wisconsin and being Hmong, I really didn't know about my history until I went to college and wasn't really proud of my identity because a lot of folks thought I was Chinese. And so I think the significance of this is that Wisconsin has the third largest Hmong population. And so specifically for the Hmong students now, they'll know about themselves and their culture and why they're here in America and their identities, and their peers will know more about them, which then will foster more belonging, less bullying. Their teachers will know more about them, and so will foster a better relationship so they feel more safe and supported at school. And so there's huge significance in that. And then in addition to, there's just so much diaspora in Asian American history. So that is the next tough thing to decide what this instruction will look like. But I think Lorna and I have had conversations with Illinois, who was the first state that passed this. And we've learned a lot of things from their passing of there may be a baseline or standard of how and providing that content and context. But what's unique about Wisconsin, and I think that's why maybe Governor Evers celebrated in different pockets of Wisconsin, is that we're not congregated in the Twin Cities in Minnesota or in big cities like California. We're actually scattered all throughout Wisconsin. So it being statewide now, it doesn't matter where you are, you're going to learn about some aspect of Hmong or Asian American history. So I think that's super powerful.
Absolutely. And I like that you kind of talked about trying to figure out what's next and how to really go about this instruction, who would be involved in that process, and when could students expect to be learning about more Hmong and Asian American history?
You know, one of the things that one of the DPI leaders, actually for the Native American community, has said is that the first thing you need to do is include. And one thing this bill shows is that by adding Hmong Americans and Asian Americans into the statute, it's inclusion. It's saying, hi, we're here. And I think that'll be very important, not only for our educators, as well as our communities, to realize that this is important to give that kind of recognition to our communities, but also that it is now what another person has told me is a protected class. In other words, it's included. And the next one is integration, meaning let's get our stories in there at every level, and the histories and the specific, maybe factoids, but the final stage and the ultimate stage is infusion, which is that it's not just a social studies history class. It's a way to make sure that every grade level teachers and kids are learning about the Asian communities that are local in their area, as well as what the big national histories have been. And infusion means that it's not just the social studies teacher or the English teacher who should be teaching, history or books that are by Asians, but that even the band teacher or the gym teacher or whatever, they all set up a community where it's a healthy learning environment for their kids. So it's not something that's just going to be overnight. It's something that, our communities will need to work together to facilitate that, and particularly within each community.
I wish we can give you a date. And I think that getting the bill passed itself speaks to how long that took. So I think what is important to us is the quality of content that's going to be put out there, which is going to take time. And I think your question about who makes those decisions, I think that it's important that we hear from our students, because they're the ones that are actually going to reap the benefits. Lorna and I are not in schools anymore. So I think that we need to hear from the students, and we need to hear about what experiences or what they want to learn about their identity. And that could be a starting point, but it definitely does include everyone, because everyone was part of this effort in passing the bill. And so I think everyone is encouraged to continue being a part of the effort up until that infusion.
I want to know if you guys just have any thoughts about why it took so long for Hmong American, Asian American history to be mandated in schools, if there's anything you think might have contributed to that.
I think the biggest, what's the difference between it being pushed before and now, is that actually in the past couple of years, we just got our first AAPI legislator, Representative Francesca Hong. So she played a huge role in continuing to put this in the forefront at the Capitol, and also advocating at both parties to co-sponsor this bill and pass it through. And so I think there's just power in that representation. I think there was even a representative at the Milwaukee celebration saying, sometimes there's a good idea, but there's not momentum. And so the good idea has been there for a while, but I think with Hong's momentum and letting us know at all hours of the day what is happening at the Capitol and what we can do to push coalition members and students and families to show up at the Capitol or do what we need to do to build that momentum. That's the difference, I think, of like then and now.
So, you know, talking about history that really centers communities of color, either struggles or triumphs, it tends to be challenged. And I think we see that now, particularly with Black history, for example, where certain lessons, certain Black figures, books are being taken out of schools. So I just wonder, are you concerned, as you all continue to really formulate what will be included over the next however long timeline, right? Are you all concerned that certain aspects of Hmong American or Asian American history might be challenged in some way to say, actually, no, let's not look at this?
You know, that there will always be pushback against any initiative that's taken for people who are not in the majority in particular. And everyone has their own stories and experiences that may make each person feel not seen, invisible, and makes it very difficult to rise above that with the majority. So yeah, that's an issue. And I think one thing we've been able to do throughout this whole period in the last at least decade in moving forward with the bills, there's been 5 attempts. This was the 5th attempt with the legislature to do this, is to focus on what it brings to all kids and not just to Asian American kids. And that, you know, this is a very multicultural society, and for our kids to not be aware of each other's differences and similarities and humanizing each person's experience, it's a real disservice to those kids as they enter the work world. And so those are some of the themes we've maintained, as to say, this is why education is an important aspect of moving this through with our school systems.
Yeah, and I'll just add, I mean, there's definitely concerns. I think, again, hearing from a state that has already passed it and is a little further along with like their implementation, they have elevated the challenges of implementation. And so I think that one way that we can, if these challenges come up while we are going through the process, I think one way that we can kind of overcome that is to talk to other states, but also talk to other communities, because the original act that included Black, Indigenous, and Latinx communities, they probably have gone through something similar where their history wasn't reflected correctly. And so speaking to other communities too, of like, what did you all do when that happened? How do you hold other people accountable? How do we course correct? And so I think that that is a way that, you know, we unfortunately can't control every classroom, right? But I think that what we can do is talk and have that dialogue to ensure that the history is like really reflecting the community. And sometimes I think, Lauren, I don't know if this is what you told me, but someone said like history could be subjective and perspective sometimes. And so I think it's also interesting to have those conversations of like, this is what we felt on this side, and this is what we heard on that side, and have that conversation, because both could also coexist. And so it just is the perspective of who was in power and who was in not, right? And so I think that it's just, it opens up that conversation, but I think there's definitely going to be mistakes. There's definitely going to be concerns, and we sort of have a game plan, hopefully, to combat and just figure those things out, learning from other communities who have already implemented this.
Yihir Vang and Lorna Young are members of the Asian American and Pacific Islander Coalition of Wisconsin. They spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell. In about 15 minutes, we'll visit the Hagerty Museum of Art to learn about Dynamic Range, an exhibit filled with photographs by Bill Tennyson documenting the city's Black community from the 1980s to the early 2000s. But first, we'll speak with a drag queen at the center of a documentary called Ladylike about her experiences shooting the film. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you're a fan of the popular reality TV show RuPaul's Drag Race, or simply admire the art of drag, you might be interested in the documentary Ladylike. It's showing this week during the Milwaukee Film Festival. The film follows the story of London-born, San Francisco-based drag queen Lady Camden as she's catapulted into the spotlight in season 14 of RuPaul's Drag Race. It also takes an intimate look at Camden's life as she learns to navigate fame while coming to terms with her childhood experiences in London. To learn more about the making of this film, Camden joins Lake Effect's Excrete Nunez.
Ladylike is a beautiful documentary that explores your life before, during, and after your season of RuPaul's Drag Race. Why did you and the director, Luke Willis, decide to make this film? Set the scene for me. How did that conversation come up?
Well, it's a good question. Luke and I both come from like a ballet theater, super ballet bunhead background. We've both had careers on stage before his career in filmmaking and before my explosion of Lady Camden. And we'd already been working on like little mini films together throughout my season. We were sort of working on content essentially for Instagram so that we could have like fun, fierce things to post during the progression of my season. So I think that Luke already had in the back of his mind that he wanted to do a feature length something, maybe involving me, involving this sort of theatrical element to it. And when I was talking to him candidly about ballet, why it's important to me, and found like a safe space within the ballet world after, you know, getting bullied, like a lot of queer kids sort of experienced at school, ballet was the first like safe space for me. It was the first time I could feel super feminine and not be ridiculed for that. It was finally then that I realized I don't need a reason to dance. It just makes me happy. It makes me feel safe. And I think he related to that story from his own experiences, which is why he kind of got inspired to start following my journey, because I think he started to relate to it more than he realized.
And so, like you mentioned, this documentary is much more than your journey through Drag Race. It's very personal to your life. But by the end of it, I feel like you were my best friend. Like, I feel like I already know you.
Aww,
and I was just rooting for you. But how was filming it? How did you build that trust with Luke and let your walls down?
Well, first of all, we can always be best friends. Like, you can call me up anytime you like. You have my number now. You know, I'm not going to lie. It's definitely a weird, awkward experience to have someone following you around with a camera and ask you personal questions. I'm getting better, but I'm not very good at, like, being organized with my thoughts under pressure. So I think that during the airing of my season, a lot of queens experience this. There's just an influx of attention and texts and emails and needs and wants. And a lot of people need your attention and need something done from you or asking a lot of you. And if you're not used to that, it's a lot. So I think him filming me during all that process, I'm not going to lie, I didn't love every second of it. Sometimes I wanted to just be alone. But I think because I know Luke prior to this, I've gotten to know how sensitive as a person Luke is and how, you know, has a really big heart and is kind of a big softie like I am, like deep down. So I kind of had a feeling, I don't think Luke is going to throw me under the bus here. I think he's going to like try to do something beautiful with this as opposed to creating some sort of like World of Wonder expose or, you know, try to make me look like something that I'm not. I kind of just had a feeling that he's like hopeful like I am, and he's kind of the eternal optimist. So I sort of felt like I think he'll make something that I can sign off on.
And as a viewer, you're mentioning this, I felt like Ladylike was a love letter to the art of drag. But what were your thoughts when you first watched the film, like your first time?
You know, I think the awkward parts feel really awkward to watch. The fun celebratory moments are just fun to relive. I'm never sort of someone that wants people to like feel sorry for me or something. So I think it was hard for me to watch me talking about hardships because I just, my biggest fear is that people think that I'm like, oh my God, like my life is so hard. I feel so, you know, like that was the main worry. I'm not really that person. I'm more sort of like, well, here's a positive side. Let's move on. So that was hard. And for me, like personally, not to spoil the film, but like at the end, there's a bit of a resolution of like, well, this happened, that didn't happen, this happened, that didn't happen. You know, I've always had a hard time really gaining the confidence to like fully be myself for like most of my life. And that's not really something you want to hear a drag queen say. You know, that's not what you expect them to say. But I think I learned sort of through the whole journey that there is a different way to sort of let everyone have it and be yourself. And it just might not look the way you thought it was going to look when you were 16. Right. You know, I think a lot of us have really specific goals at certain points in our lives. And it's fun to look back and go, it really was not what I thought it was going to be, but it's not bad. You know, it's great.
No, I totally get it. So I want to shift it to a little more serious note. During a time when there's such visceral hate toward the art of drag, this film really celebrates queer expression and is beautifully really unapologetic about it. What does it mean to you to release this film right now?
I think a lot of people who are afraid of queer people or talk about this agenda that we have, or people that are just sort of against queer people having the rights to be a human and have human rights, are just really afraid of the unknown, and they don't know someone queer, they don't know someone who's a drag queen, they don't know a trans person, so they're afraid of what they don't know, they assume the worst. I think as humans, we do that, we are afraid of the unknown, we speculate, we come up with like a story in our mind of what the other side is wanting to do. This is just an example of someone living their life, going through their journey of self-acceptance, self-exploration, in a way that doesn't affect or hurt anyone else. It's literally just a child growing up into someone that they've always dreamed of being, but sort of having to shed all the self-shame, shed all of the insecurities, shed a lot of like hard stuff that is put on you as you navigate this world as a teenager and as a young adult. And then at the other side of it going, you know what? I don't deserve that. I don't want that. All I deserve right now is just to like be myself, whether that means getting into drag or whatever that means. It's just really like an example of a queer person's life, which I think is something that people need to see. They need to see that we are beautiful, complicated, layered individuals that have opinions and we want to be loved. And that's really it. We just want to navigate our lives freely. We just want to like do our thing and like make other people feel good along the way. there's no other objective here. There's nothing evil about it. There's nothing like, you know what I mean? There's nothing like dark or sinister. And yeah, I think that this film to me is like a love letter to my younger self too. I think it's like giving younger self permission to have fun and enjoy it. And, you know, a lot of my therapy has been looking back on times when like younger selves, whether you're like 9 or 16 or 21 or whatever it is, when they're triggered, when they've been through stuff, it's like looking back and trying to hold that kid's hand and like let them see what you've built and let them actually like go, wow, that's so cool. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's sort of what this film has meant to me personally. And I would love like younger queer people to see this and let themselves enjoy the good stuff that happens to them as it happens. Don't wait until you're in your 30s to look back and go, wow, that was cool. You know?
Mm-hmm. No, that was what I was going to ask you, is if you had any advice for current or up and coming performers.
You know, I think you're going to meet so many people in your life. You're going to be inspired by so much. I think you're going to want to sort of try to please a lot of people. I look around and like some of the best friends that I have today are the same best friends that I had when I was like 12. And you have a feeling in your heart who's good for you and who's maybe not. And I think you know instinctually what is good for you and what isn't. Like what jobs make you just like deeply really excited and happy, even if it might not impress other people as much or might not impress such and such. I think you know your instincts, what's going to make you like just grow to be a bigger, better rock star version of yourself, and what is going to kind of like stifle you and mute you. So I would say to any young people to not ignore that instinct, not ignore, I feel like this is my bestie and she loves me and she wants nothing but the best for me. Like hold on to those people. We all have them. And then we all have these people that we kind of want to impress, but they don't really care about us. And you know the difference. And I think that like I would just say to any young queer performer or artist or person, listen to your instincts, trust them. It's not your job to take care of everyone. It's your job to take care of yourself first and foremost. And then allow people to, you know, enjoy your journey with you, but ultimately make sure that you're taken care of first.
Well, Lady Camden, thank you so much for speaking with me today. And I'm really excited for more people to watch Ladylike.
Yay, me too. I'm excited for it to travel the world a little bit and maybe, hopefully, fingers crossed, get a home online someday. We'll see.
Lady Camden is the focus of the documentary film, Ladylike. She spoke with Leg Effects' Axgrit Nunez. You can see the film this Thursday and Friday as a part of the Milwaukee Film Festival. You can also hear a longer version of this conversation at WUWM.com. Milwaukee Film is a financial contributor to WUWM. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, but ahead of that, we need some new questions from you. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com, then listen for new episodes starting in May on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. We'll take one more break and then return with local photographer Bill Tennyson to learn about his career documenting Milwaukee's Black community for the Milwaukee Community Journal. Some of his work is on display at the Hagerty Museum of Art, and we'll go there next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Like Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Bill Tennyson is a self-taught photographer from Milwaukee. And while he wouldn't call himself a professional, since 1981, he's been contributing photographs to the Milwaukee Community Journal, Wisconsin's largest African-American newspaper. A new exhibit called Dynamic Range at the Hagerty Museum of Art features Tennyson's photographs that capture a range of local history. From Juneteenth celebrations to Marquette and Bucks basketball games, the Ernest Lacey inquest, and visiting cultural and political figures, the exhibit documents Milwaukee's Black community from the 1980s to the early 2000s. To find out more about the exhibit and to get the perspective from the artist himself, I met Bill Tennyson and curator Lynn Schumo at the Hagerty on the campus of Marquette University.
Bill and Lynn, thank you for having me at the Hagerty. It's a pleasure to be here with you and to see your work today.
Oh, it's really nice of you to come down. I'm so happy that people want to see my photographs.
So Bill, you put a dark room in your parents' basement when you were about 13 years old. What photographs were you inspired by, and what subjects were you drawn to shoot as a young teenager? What started the interest?
Yes, that's correct. I did build a dark room, what my parents called the fruit cellar, at our house on 39th Street, just south of Silver Spring Drive. And I did borrow my mother's Kodak box camera. It had film size 1/16, and I thought if I would point it at things such as there was a beautiful bridge in McGovern Park, and I thought if I took a picture of that, that would be considered fine art. And I think I might still have those first roll of film negatives in my possession. Probably not really fine art, but I thought they were.
Well, and to get into it at such a young age, just for recreation purposes, is really inspiring. And your hobby of photography eventually led you to work with the Milwaukee Community Journal for a long time. Can you share how that relationship first started?
It had a soft start and then a harder start. The softer start was I was taking photographs of the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Milwaukee and the YWCA and several other nonprofits. They, of course, loved to have all the publicity they could get, and so occasionally I would drop off photographs at the Milwaukee Community Journal, hopefully that they would get published in the paper and my clients would be happy. When I call my clients, they're just nominally clients. I wasn't really doing it professionally. Then it picked up when I decided to photograph the Ernest Lacey inquest. I think this is 1981. And without any advance notification to the hearing people, I just showed up in the courtroom with a camera. And the judge was quite upset with me. It was very early on when they were first allowing cameras in courtrooms. And he wasn't quite sure if I was allowed to be there or not. And that has led to a very, in my mind, a very serious incident, in which he stopped the inquest and called me to his chambers and basically kicked me out of the trial or courtroom. This apparently happened on three occasions. I only remember the first one, but there's a letter in the show from the editor of the Milwaukee Community Journal saying that I'd been kicked out of his courtroom on three occasions. And they, of course, wanted photographs of the Lacey inquest. This was a very serious matter, and I was able to provide photographs in the courtroom, not a lot of them, but some, but more importantly, later on in the street protests.
Yeah, Ernest Lacey was a 22-year-old black man who was killed in police custody in 1981, and the trial you mentioned is for the three officers after. And there's a wall right to the right of us here at the Hagerty Museum dedicated to Ernest Lacey and the marches and the protests. We also have community, Juneteenth, some other categories. So Lynn, I want to bring you in here. This exhibit is filled with Bill's photographs documenting the city's black community from the 1980s to the early 2000s. So can you share a bit more detail about some of the major highlights and how you and the team went through, I'm sure, hundreds, what, thousands of photographs to make a theme throughout the show?
Well, Bill has hundreds of thousands of negatives, fewer prints, fortunately. So I went to his house with a couple of helpers, and we started sorting through hundreds and hundreds of prints, and certain themes emerged. The title, Dynamic Range, most people won't know that it has multiple meanings. Dynamic range is actually a photographic term that refers to the ratio between black and white in a black and white print. So, and of course, dynamic range also means, you know, very many different types of photographs. So we ultimately settled on these eight different themes and then did a small selection of photographs that fit with each of those themes. It wasn't easy because there's just so much to choose from. And I think ultimately the range of the photographs demonstrates different types of things. I wanted to show the joy in the black community, but I also wanted to make sure some of the challenges were highlighted. So that's where you get these very different sort of themes represented.
Yeah, I see we have storefront churches, the arts, sports, Juneteenth community, Ernest Lacey. We're next to Juneteenth here, and Bill, I'd love to talk to you about these celebrations that you photographed over the years. And Juneteenth has been celebrated here in Milwaukee for over 50 years. So what are some words or feelings that go along with your photos of Juneteenth that you feel, whether it's looking at them today or remembering how you felt taking those photos?
I always really enjoy Juneteenth Day, and I look forward to it each year, and that it really was a fun outdoor celebration. I enjoyed the horse riding group that would take little kids for horseback rides, and that provided good photo opportunities. There were gatherings of groups of people that just got together to have a good time. The police were very comfortable with the goings-ons in that. One of my favorite photographs in the show is in a Juneteenth. It's not in the Juneteenth section of the show, but it's in the community section.
Here, let's walk over to it. Show me which one.
It shows two police officers standing against a wall or a building, and one or two local guys with open 40-ounce bottles of beer in their hands talking to the officers. Normally, the rest of the year, that would get you in big trouble, but that's one of my favorite photographs.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you never staged any of your photographs, right?
No. There's two things I would like to say about the photographs. That is, every single one is just the way it was. The photograph that they're using of the kids with the very large boom box, they asked me to take their picture, and I have two negatives. They're 35 millimeter negatives, and the first one, they're just kind of loosely standing around. The second one, which is on the cover of the brochure for the show, is more formal, and they just asked me to do it. And other photographs where things happened, they just happened. People would say, take my photograph, and this is the result of it. But none of these were prepared for the show. These are just my file photographs. These are all vintage prints from back in the 80s and 90s. And there would be a very dramatic cutoff when I went to digital photography and that there are no longer any prints.
Well, and with such spontaneous moments of connection that you captured on film, how did it feel to see and work with this physical media again?
Every photograph in here, I developed the film. I made the prints, and that's the way photography used to be.
Bill wanted to be surprised with the exhibition. We worked on it for, I would say, a year and a half, and there was a lot of fact-checking and a lot of writing. And throughout the process, I had a number of questions for Bill, like dates and whatnot. And I had created a checklist that I sent to him, but he didn't want to see it. So when the exhibition opened, it was the first time he knew exactly what was going to be in it, and was, I think, pleasantly surprised.
How'd you feel, Bill, seeing your work?
Well, let me come at it just slightly differently. I think they took about 100 photographs from my house. Several weeks before the show opened, they called me and said, you can pick up the rejects. I have not looked at the rejects. I didn't want to be disappointed and say, why didn't they use this beautiful photograph? And so I just took the rejects back home, and they're still in a file on my desk. So I obviously knew some of the photographs they were using from the questions and so on, but I deliberately wanted to be a little surprised, and I was.
Rejects. It was just a matter of, you know, we had just so much wall space and so many pieces that fit the theme. So nothing was a reject. Just some were not as usable as others.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure it was a tough task to even narrow down to the great representation you have. And as you mentioned, Lynn, the themes in this room, being in this room, seeing what is chosen of the collection of your photographs. How do you feel about your role in capturing the Milwaukee community over the years? How does it make you feel?
Well, I just enjoy doing it. I sometimes in my mind compare, not compare my photography, but compare the nature of my photographs with Walker Evans. Walker Evans was a street photographer back in the 1930s. He took photographs that anybody with a camera could have done. There's nothing special about them, but now, 80 years later, they are really interesting to see what his cities that he visited looked like 80 or 85 years ago. And I like to think that maybe my photographs, another 50 years from now, have a similar feel for somebody and say, wow, that's what it used to look like.
I mean, I certainly love seeing these different photos. So, Bill, I want to thank you for sharing some of them with me today, and Lynn, for your work in putting them together. Thank you so much.
Well, this has really been fun, eh? And thank you so much for coming to look at my photographs.
Absolutely.
Bill Tennyson is a photographer, and Lynn Schumo is the curator for academic engagement at the Hegarty Museum of Art. The exhibit Dynamic Range, Photographs by Bill Tennyson, is on display now through May 12th. You can see some of the photos from the exhibit that we talked about in our conversation at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll explore a legal challenge that's going before the state Supreme Court that could reshape the power balance between the governor's office and the legislature. Plus, we'll continue our Behind the Scenes at MPM series by looking at a museum collection not on display for the public. Join us tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.